Investors Chronicle.
Companies and Markets Podcast, 9th of February 2023. Alex Hamer's in the studio. Hi, Alex.
Hey.
Alex Newman as well.
Hi, John. How are you doing?
Yeah, very well. Julian Hoffman. Hello, Julian.
Hello there, John.
And Dan Jones hosting as usual. Coming up today, Dan.
Hi, John. We start with the oil majors, BP and Shell, looking at the year they've just had and what could be coming in the year ahead. Then we turn to Unilever, which we discussed briefly last week. We're going to be looking in more detail at their figures coming up. And finally, we are going to be talking about the house builders, a few reports in the past few days, a few interim figures, and maybe some greenish shoots there.
Lovely. Before that, another week of news has been and gone. Here's some of the highlights from the IC's coverage. BP joined other oil and gas majors in revealing bumper profits for 2022. Their figure came in at around $28 billion, over double 2021's figures. The company also said it now aims to reduce fossil fuel waste by around 25% through to 2030, compared to the previous target of 40%. UK retail sales growth contracted in January as shoppers cut back due to inflationary pressures. According to KPMG and the British Retail Consortium, total UK retail sales rose by 4.2% in January, down from 12% seen in January last year. The administrators of British Volt, the startup building an electric vehicle battery plant in Northumberland, are selling most of its business and assets to Australian firm Recharge Industries. Administrators said Recharge had been chosen following multiple approaches from interested parties. AIM-traded oil and gas exploration business Deltic Energy has struck gold in British waters. Deltic said a well test had confirmed, quote, one of the largest natural gas discoveries in the southern North Sea in over a decade, end quote, with estimates putting the size of the gas deposit at 300 billion cubic feet, which seemed like a big number to me. And the FTSE 100 hit a record high this week, just below the 8,000-point mark, and it's testing that figure again today as we speak. It's up around 1.5% for the last 5 days or so. A few companies in brief to finish. Beverage giant Diageo has increased its stake in East African Breweries, a branded alcohol company focusing on Kenya, Uganda and Tanzania. Defence company Avon Protection has landed a $6 million order for military helmets from the US. And finally, the tool hire company Speedy Hire has launched an investigation into £20 million worth of missing kit. Speaking of expensive tools, back to you, Dan.
Don't know what to make of that. I'm gonna gloss over it. You helpfully said at the beginning there, John, BP and Shell both reported record years last year, as you would expect, given everything that's been going on. The numbers are certainly, you know, outsized profits, if not excess, as critics would undoubtedly say. 40 billion for Shell, 28 billion for BP. But the big focus, as ever, is on the year ahead. Alex Hamer, you are here to discuss these figures, the outlook. What can we expect in the year ahead? I mean, you know, is this a not quite a last hurrah, but certainly the peak? It's probably fair to say. What's, you know, in brief, the outlook for 2023 from a, you know, revenue point of view?
As I gaze into my crystal ball with highly accurate information about this year,
Start with an easy question.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to come to it seemingly the third or fourth time. We cover this sector for about 4 years. Third or fourth time that I'm forecasting a peak of something. Previously, it might have been oil demand, 2019. I guess the peak of the oil majors is as integrated energy companies as we used to know them. They've obviously come back around to that idea of being pretty pure play oil and gas companies. And that's what we saw this week, where BP shifted back some of its emission reduction plans, and those are operational emission reductions. So, you know, which is kind of a small part of their overall impact, but, you know, what that means in reality is that they want to be producing more oil and gas. And for Shell, it's certainly more gas. It's the strategy that they launched a few years ago, with that BG purchase. And they, under their new CEO, well, so on, you know, they're looking really bullish. For investors, what that means is this year that we're going to see higher dividends. BP surprised with its 10% dividend increase this week. And, you know, the share prices have moved in response. And I think what's interesting looking at forecasts, we do see dividends ticking up for BP and Shell in the coming years. And that's always been their model, really. You know, you go back decades and they just don't cut their dividends until, you know, I think Shell went from World War II, the end of World War II, to 2 years ago before there was a dividend cut. So that's traditionally been their model and they look to be embracing that. And for context, you know, to go back to your peak question, Dan, which was what you were really asking for an answer for, this really is, at least in the short term, kind of a high watermark for these companies. I think analysts, you know, this is kind of probably well over a dozen or two dozen analysts have, you know, with the consensus that 2022 was the high watermark for earnings, profits, but as I've just said, not so much dividends. The other factor there is the buyback programs. So that's where they're throwing this extra free cash, you know, for investors, and that's increased the returns significantly. But yeah, it's interesting. You see, look at the free cash forecast for the next few years, and you know they are going to shrink a lot. So all that figure is going to shrink. So for BP, for example, its free cash flow over the next 3-4 years, it's going to go from it was 22.7 billion last year, and that's going to be halved within 2 years or within 3 years. So, you know, this really was a pretty extraordinary year.
Yeah. As you say there, I mean, there are some interesting operational decisions being made at the same time for the year ahead, the obvious one being the scaling back of those green ambitions, as you and John touched on. How does that, maybe if we sort of get into BP's thinking a bit more there, because on one level, you know, it's obvious the energy supply situation has changed over the last year, so they're thinking, well, actually, you know, our forecasts for that decline might be a bit misplaced, which may be why they're now saying, you know, come 2030, we'll have less in renewables than we thought. Equally, you know, the company, its shareholder returns are quite a bit lower than Shell. It seems funny saying that when you produce 28 billion, but when you look at shareholder returns, you know, Shell and in particular the US majors are quite a bit higher, which, you know, there's an element of windfall tax in there. I suppose BP has more UK operations, but also it's because it seems to me that those companies are more highly valued by investors at the moment because they are still pretty much fully geared into, you know, the fossil fuel bonanza, if you will. So, I mean, BP, it had the good share price reaction this week. Management going to be partly thinking, we want to align ourselves actually, you know, after a few years of trying to be more ESG friendly, we want to actually align ourselves with, you know, the US majors, with Shell a bit more, and just say, look, we're going to really go for this on fossil fuels still. And you saw the share price reaction. So that seems to be what investors want at the moment.
Yeah. And it's just seemingly this approach that really values our immediate past, really. You know, this past year, you know, there's been such a focus on energy security, and we've seen the impacts of there not being enough oil and gas in the market. You know, prices for everyone have gone way up. At the same time, you know, a lot of the pressures that brought on these lower carbon strategies from 3 years ago haven't gone away, but you just have less pressure from governments and certainly from investors in terms of cutting emissions and taking responsibility for the end use emissions when these products are burned. But you know, we've just seen a new case come into the British courts this week where the directors of Shell will face you know, more scrutiny for not sticking to UK climate goals. I'm just going to fact check myself because it might have been BP.
It was Shell.
It was Shell.
The client Earth.
Yeah. So the Client Earth court case. And I think, you know, for institutional investors, there are some who have joined this court case, but there are others who have pushed a long time for a balance between continuing to invest in oil and gas, but not too much, obviously, because you don't want an oversupply, and throwing a bit of money at next generation, you know, earnings generators, basically. I mean, there's never been a sense that a few wind farms and a hydrogen plant will replace the cash generation of extracting oil and gas. There's just no chance that'll ever happen. So we're in this kind of middle stage, and I think we've swung fairly strongly from you know, one crisis state with the pandemic where dividends were cut, strategies were changed, and now we've gone the other way. And you assume that we will find some middle ground which will be acceptable to perhaps a retail investor, obviously not someone like Client Earth or Greenpeace, and perhaps also not acceptable or, you know, the perfect position for a really bullish on oil and gas investor on the professional level. So perhaps that middle ground is a bit more comfortable for the retail investor, though.
Yeah, they are trying to thread that needle, aren't they? I mean, the CapEx spend for next year, unlike Shell, does seem to be going up a little bit, and they have said by 2030, as well as scaling back those ambitions, they will invest, I think it was, $8 billion in transition businesses, $8 billion more than they previously said, also $8 billion more on oil and gas investments. So I suppose that sums up the balance they're trying to strike.
Yeah, and we've already seen it. I mean, Shell basically had a complete reserve replacement. Well, not 100%, but they basically replaced everything they extracted last year through exploration and acquisitions. So this process, and that's a continual process for these companies because, you know, they have to stay in operation this way. But, you know, they're already thinking about that. And I think Shell certainly has a bullish on gas specifically, CEO through the door now, who might make different decisions. And he's certainly facing a different set of pressures than Ben Burden, who left at the end of December. So, yeah, it's an interesting stage. I think yes, this is a peak in terms of profits, and also potentially a peak for governments laying off on the emissions rhetoric as well. So, yeah, but there's certainly plenty of cash to come for investors.
Yeah. Alex Newman, do you have any thoughts? BP Shell.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that stood out for me in both results was the just the performance of their trading division. So not just about capturing price, sort of spot price windfalls really from the last year's spike in gas and oil prices, but how their trading divisions and their sort of their downstream divisions just absolutely drowning in cash last year. And I suppose some element, I mean, all elements of these businesses are hard to predict when it comes to cash flows, because they do depend really on very unpredictable markets. But the level, you know, I think it's something at the same time that investors can't rule out, even if there are some signs that, you know, profits might be peaking, or it's hard to see how a confluence of factors like the past years could be so, you know, so supportive again this year or next year to their profits. But it's always, you know, it's always kind of the option there, which kind of can be overlooked easily, because, you know, they, you know, I think the products division that BP had, they sort of tripled their profits to over $10 billion in 2022, and that's, you know, that is kind of acts as an accelerator for the other things they want to do, like bring down their debts, for example, which they've taken an axe to in the last year, and they say they want to do more of that. I mean, even if free cash flow is peaking, I think they're now guiding for nearly $50 billion of cash profits by 2025, assuming $70 oil. And they're already on an enterprise value to cash profit ratio of less than of 2.5. So this, you know, that could fall a lot further if they take a further axe to their debts, their interest payments coming down. You know, and they, you know, they might look cheaper still in a couple of years' time. But yeah, as ever with this sector, you know, that's assuming there's not an oil price crash or, you know, something goes disastrously wrong for one of their wells. So it's so high risk, but at the same time, you can understand how, you know, how people see the opportunity in their near-term profits, I suppose.
Well, let's turn to another dividend stalwart now, Unilever, which had full-year figures out today. It's a similar story to what we've seen over the past few quarters. Volume still under pressure, pricing able to offset that pretty effectively for now. We get a little bit more detail, as you'd expect, with the full-year figures on what could be coming for the year ahead, which seems to boil down to a bit more margin pressure, perhaps. We can come on to margins in a minute. Also, though, you know, some discussion of how long inflation is going to last for consumer goods companies, which does seem to be the big question of 2023 and when that pivot will come. Julian, Unilever, what are your thoughts on how the business has been holding up? They had a pretty good year last year, all told. How do you see these figures?
It wasn't too bad. I mean, I was a bit disappointed that there was no sign that they're going to change their name to Procter & Gamble. But apart from that, they seem to be managing the worst of the inflation environment. It's actually now down to how consumers will react, I think. I don't think Unilever can do much more than it has done into this situation. But the new chief executive definitely has a lot to do. Yeah, so he's moving on from the, you know, a few sort of strategic errors that the company made, and they're guiding actually for a decent amount of 2023 growth. So they're looking at sort of 3-5% sales growth for 2023, which on the basis that you know, a lot of that is going to come out of under pressure consumer goods, so it's not bad at all. So I mean, it was all right. I mean, you can't complain on that basis. Just really what impact the new manager is going to have when it comes down to it. But we'll see. I mean, that's obviously a question of time, really, rather than predictions.
Yeah. Some of the underlying issues for the business, as we say, there is that split between volumes and price, you know, pushing through double-digit price increases each quarter is a testament to the brand, if you want to call it that, but it does come at some volume expense. So far, the volume's been holding up pretty well. You might have expected, I think, more people to shift to private label alternatives, which is always the big fear for this sector, especially in a time of soaring inflation. But that hasn't really happened to the same extent as some people might have thought.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how people experience inflation. I mean, whether some people's pay packets have kept up with the prices is a completely different question. That certainly seems to happen in America. We're not quite sure if that's the same here in the UK. But yeah, the input costs, you know, as far as they're concerned, their input costs are actually going down slightly, although they're still at a relatively high level. And the outlook is still volatile. So none of that adds up to a great deal of visibility, which is really how the market reacted today. It wasn't particularly up or down, but they, you know, they can't really guide to anything particularly until they have more idea of what their input costs are going to look like. And I mean, that isn't likely to happen before the first quarter of this year, before that becomes a bit more clear. I would have said, but
certainly in terms of the analyst community, it seems the two things they're waiting for are one, margin pressure, and there's some suggestion that margin reset did already happen last year with you know, the pricing pressures and various company specific pressures we have seen, which would tend to be, you know, if that does bear out, if that peak or if that trough in margins has already happened, then that's quite different from previous recessions. I think it tends to happen a little bit later on, so it's quite hard to see how that will play out. But then the other big one, as you say, is inflation price growth. I think the big analyst hope has been, given the way certainly soft commodities have been falling in price the past few months, the big hope has being that come the second half of this year, we'll see those inflation figures rolling over. We'll see prices therefore start to roll over as well. There's always a bit of a lag, so that could give, you know, a boost to margins, a boost to top and bottom lines. So far, I think you saw it again with Unilever today. I think the CFO said we've seen the peak in inflation maybe, but not the peak in pricing. We've got a lot of consumer goods companies reporting in the next few weeks. They're probably going to say something similar. But then it is in their interest to be very cautious on pricing, because when you think about these companies, when we've seen a lot in recent months, haven't we, with the likes of Tesco getting into arguments with Heinz, things like that, it's in consumer goods companies' interest to say that pricing is still difficult and they have to put these through, because as soon as there's a perception that we're at this peak, the retailers are going to be all over them and say, right, we want price cuts now. We need, you know, some of these prices to start, if not coming down, then, you know, introduce some discounting, some offers. So there are challenges there.
Well, it all comes down to how much are you prepared to pay for Dove? So what is the optimum price for soap? It should be, I mean, the gold standard will be Procter & Gamble when they report, and the companies are always put side by side. And we'll see whether they've managed their cost base and their price rises better than Unilever. I mean, the betting probably will is that they have when the results come out. But it's another chief executive you don't really envy. It's a very difficult turnaround, long-term turnaround that he has to do there.
Mm. And he's kind of coming in midway through, in that a decent amount is in the price. You could argue with Unilever, you look at some multiples, they had a good year last year. EV to EBITDA is looking, you know, relatively fully valued versus peers, partly because they've begun this turnaround. They've had an internal reorganization. There is a lot of hope that that will bear fruit. They've shown they can resist pricing strains last year. So it's quite hard for them. And they've, you know, had the boost from Nelson Peltz being on the board as well. So it's quite hard to come in and you've effectively got to deliver on what the market and a lot of investors are already hoping and pricing in.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much the difficult point for an investor is what's the run going to be after this? Because, I mean, they're a little bit below their sort of 5-year average. So they're trading at 17 times earnings at the moment, where the average is about 19. So the amount of value left in it is marginal, and it's really going to be about how they kind of manage expectations so that they can get back to where they should be, as it were. I don't know if and there isn't, as far as I could see, not a lot left in it, if that makes any sense.
I was going to say, just on that point, the, you know, the 17 times versus 19 times doesn't sound like a big difference, but I suppose the, you know, for UK investors or any investor really, the really important thing about that 17 times number is, you know, what it translates to in terms of earnings yield. So like 17 times forward earnings is an earnings yield of just below 6%. And if you're an investor right now, you can get, you know, gilts aren't fantastic. They're sort of 3.5% ish, depending on how long you're holding them for. But like US Treasuries, which would be the real benchmark for most big investors looking at Unilever right now, are between sort of 4.5% and 4.8%. So Unilever shares offer a 1 percentage point premium for all the risk of running a business and the challenge of passing on all these price rises to a possibly fatigued consumer. I agree. I think it's so much of it is in the price, really. There's not a lot of value left on the table unless you're taking a very long-term view on. I think it's amazing we've got this far without talking about mayonnaise, because I feel like we've talked about mayonnaise so many times in the last year. But that, you know, the growth options for the business, and maybe that has just to come from new products, new or new acquisitions, which we've not really talked about. But
divestments as well are certainly on the table again, it seems, or certainly being talked about with a new chief exec, you know, a way of realizing value. Just on the earnings yield, it's quite interesting. I was talking to one of our other colleagues about that this week, where you look at many different sectors and asset classes and assets right now, and, you know, you compare them to the risk-free rate, and there hasn't really been that repricing that you'd expect, you know, not just consumer goods, but everywhere. You know, the earnings yields are, you know, that spread is far tighter than it was. And you just wonder if that's going to change, or if people are happy to still buy shares for just a little premium, which, you know, would be kind of contrary to arithmetic in a lot of cases and investment philosophy. But there hasn't been as big a kind of gapping out as you might have, or as maybe I expected, given how far bond yields have moved.
Well, I think it's probably because the rotation has been quite long lasting, isn't it? So what were perceived as value shares have sort of dragged on for, you know, half a year longer than everyone expected. So that's left the yields a bit tight. I mean, it does make you wonder if nobody reaches their targets, whether the sell-off could be quite sharp in that sort of situation. I don't know what everyone else thinks, but
yeah,
that's what it came across to me. But
crystal balls at the ready. It's another well, I'm going to say we will see, because I like to say that, and who can possibly say? For now, things are still doing okay, right? But and speaking of which, we should turn to our final section of the show, which is house builders, where, as I perhaps, you know, optimistically said at the top of the show, this week some figures come through where signs of, you know, green shoots. It's probably far too early to say that, but certainly January trading, January completion reservation rates across the sector have been a bit better than December, which on one level you'd expect, given mortgage rates coming down a bit and maybe, you know, the recession we are anticipating will be shallower than was thought a couple of months ago, with energy prices also coming down. But at the same time, we know, you know, there's going to be trouble ahead. A lot of that is priced in. Alex, you've covered this sector in the past. Alex Newman, what are your thoughts on the slight improvement? Again, it's a very short period of time to look at as well, but, you know, maybe a slight sign that house prices might not be falling as much as we thought, and therefore the investment case for house builders might be fractionally better than what's been priced in.
Yeah, tough one. I suppose just to, you know, link it to our previous section, you know, there is the risk that when it comes to equities and risk assets, that people are looking two stages ahead, whereas when it comes to the house builders and sort of the UK property market, we can be very short term focused, and everything is through the prism of I suppose month on month price falls or rises, and you know, the things which, you know, you'd think would really, really drive this sector are demand and supply, which, you know, those fundamentals really didn't dictate how the shares in the sector performed last year. Because, you know, even if the government has rowed back on its 300,000 new homes target, there is still a wall of demand out there, and, you know, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of what it seems that the central, you know, bank, the Bank of England moves have been about accommodating our sort of property heavy economy. There are definite reasons to believe that it will be a better year for the house builders. I don't know if I thought it was, you know, there's an FT headline saying that the house builders rallied yesterday on Barrett's results. It looked a little bit more cautious than that to me. Partly because I think the people running these businesses really don't know how things are going to shake out in terms of house pricing, even if they sound a bit more confident on things like input costs and you know, wages and the other overheads they've had to digest over the last year or so. So yeah, I'm going to sit on the fence for this one, to be honest. But I mean, demand is not going away, even if affordability is, you know, a much bigger issue than it was even a year ago when it was an issue. So,
I'm perhaps asking too much of everyone. Asking Alex.
No, you have
asking
to ask
Alex for the VP and Shell dividend outlook, and asking you for the house price. You
know, interesting, but Chris Dillo, formerly of this parish, said recently that actually the key driver behind the market at the moment is not supply so much as the interest rate. So what a lot of the house builders are noticing is that the tail off towards the end of last year, when people were digesting higher rates, and that was partly what suppressed some appetite for buying new houses. And I mean, there is sort of anecdotal evidence of oversupply. I mean, Barrett, for example, is offering, according to some reports, that Barrett is offering like free carpets if you buy one of their houses, which some people say is a bit of a sign that you're overpaying probably for the house. You should probably wait until they offer you a free car. I think that would be the sign that you want to buy one. But yeah, so I think at best you could say the whole picture is mixed, isn't it? You can't definitively say where the market's heading, because each builder's individual experience seems to be very different, and also depending on how much mortgage the customers are carrying. So I think we noted that people like Redrow seem to have a customer base that doesn't have mortgages, whereas, you know, people like Barrett or Persimmon, they'll be the ones whose clients are more exposed to how the rates are moving. It's a curate's egg, I suppose, is the way to look at it. Good input.
I was going to come on to the difference, or certainly between the three reporting in the past few days: Barrett, Redrow, Bellway. Again, Alex, I'm gonna try and eke out some more opinions from you on their relative resilience or otherwise. I mean, is it as easy as that? As Julian correctly notes, that, you know, Redrow has got fewer first time buyers, about a third of their book or transactions are mortgage free. I think, you know, you would think that would give them the edge, but it's not as simple as that. Perhaps, I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, but I think it's definitely an advantage if you can, you know, if you've got a customer base which is able to buy in cash. And, you know, I think a lot of the commentary over the last year has been that those with the cash will do well out of this housing market correction, however far it goes. I mean, you know, Barrett's numbers, I thought, still looked, you know, even if the outlook is very uncertain, you know, they're still, with what they've got, they're still earning good returns. They're sitting on a lot of net cash, which, you know, it's not a bad position for a business to be in, that they're looking to sort of you know, wear down their cash position through dividends and share buybacks, and they're still earning, or at least in the half year, the 6 months to the end of December, they earned a return on capital of 30%. I mean, most business leaders would sort of bite your hand off at those sort of returns. But I do find it hard to square the, you know, the underlying strength of these businesses with I suppose the market's opinion that, I suppose it all comes down to how many years of long you know, continuing pain that they think they're gonna have to suffer. It's you know, as to the differences between them, they're selling similar products, you know, with or without sort of bonus carpet offers. So I think putting one between, you know, saying that one company is likely to do tremendously better than the other is a difficult call. The dividend's going to come down a little bit just because they're both well covered and they don't need to give so much away in cash necessarily. They might focus a little bit more on buybacks. Those were my eked out thoughts, I suppose.
Well, I mean, it is very early in the year, and as ever, I think we're just trying to challenge prevailing wisdom. We'll see if there's any cracks in there, and you know, the picture is evolving. It might be a little bit better than it was a few months ago, but who's to say where we'll be in a few months' time? We will keep you posted on developments in all the sectors we have covered today, from consumer goods and housing to the oil majors. I should also say that this week on the IC is our bargain shares issue, so do look out for Simon Thompson's 2023 portfolio in your latest copy. But that brings us to the end of today's show. So thank you to everyone, to Julian and to both Alex's and to John. And thank you to you for listening. We'll see you on the next Companies and Markets show.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.